May it please the court, counsel. My name is Daniel Hillis. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office, and I represent Mr. Henry on this appeal. He raises five issues, but there have been concessions by the government. So given the government's concessions on issues three and four and its position on five, I'm going to devote myself largely to the issues one and two. But before I do so, with regard to issue three, I wish to acknowledge contrary authority with respect to my position on the district court's 3553A findings and whether they are adequate to support the five-year period of supervised release. And what I wish to bring to this court's attention is Armour. And Armour decided that by making 3553A determinations in the context of the sentence, that necessarily satisfies the relevant considerations for 3583C. But of course, to accept that reading in Armour is to make 3583C ornamental, as I heard a member of this panel once address the government in an oral argument in U.S. versus Arona Ibarra about the effect of reading a separate statutory provision out of the statute book and how Congress doesn't tend to do those things. And that would be the case here. 3583C addresses the necessity of supervised release and the reasons that need to be stated for imposing it. And of course, it is discretionary here, up to 5 years. The judge didn't have to impose any supervised release. He did address 3553A factors with respect to the length of sentence, but you cannot import those factors and those determinations when they are in a separate context to say that it therefore satisfies the separate determinations that are necessary for deciding whether or not supervised release is warranted in any regard. So while 3583C requires...
What are you talking about?
There have to be separate determinations made under the statute for the two different things, the length of incarceration and the length of supervised release. That's what I'm saying.
And the government argues that because this is a drug case, that the ceiling on supervised release is, in fact, life, not 5 years. You made the argument that it was 5 years.
If I have misstated that, Your Honor, the fact remains that the determinations still have to be made to correctly impose supervised release, and that would be so. The district court didn't do that. Turning then to issues one and two, and I'll take them in reverse order. The criminal history is at issue here because the district court judge assessed criminal history points for the aggravated unlawful use of a weapon convictions, and he had two of those.
And the government thinks that there's nothing in this record to suggest that those three offenses, the two aggravated unlawful use of a weapon plus the felony criminal damage, weren't just concurrent sentences of 3 years. And in that case, even if we were to agree with you that the AUUW claims go out, there's still the criminal damage claim, and it doesn't change the calculation.
Right. That's the government's position, but the record's less than clear on that. You read a PSR, and the PSR lumps three different counts of conviction in there. My client has said since sentence was imposed, he believes it was pled down to a misdemeanor. He didn't have
a
reason.
But there's no record of that at all, right?
That's right, because he didn't have a cause to fight that. It wouldn't have made any difference in his criminal history calculations because the AUW convictions were valid.
Now, if there's a remand for full resentencing, wouldn't this issue be open?
And that's what we ask for.
I mean, why wouldn't it be open if we agreed, based on the government's concession, that a full resentencing is... So that's a sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander situation, though. So if you can supplement the record on your side, then surely it would not be appropriate to limit the government to bringing in new evidence, too, although you've asked us to impose such a limitation.
It would be a full resentencing under Thompson, and so the government could supplement it as it wishes to, and we need to supplement. And if it turns out that the criminal history is correctly calculated, that's fine. But we shouldn't accept at this juncture that the criminal history is correctly calculated, given the AUW convictions have come off the books, essentially. We need to make an inquiry about the other count of conviction. And that would affect his guideline range.
Right.
As for the final issue then, which is issue one, it's our position that the two-level leadership enhancement was incorrectly imposed, and the district court made very limited findings. But the findings...
Why? I don't understand that. This was his. He was the leader, wasn't he?
I'm not certain that he was. He recruited somebody into.
He recruits someone, and then someone helps him, and he sets the price, and splits it, and so on. So he's running things.
Well, all true. He fronted, but fronting isn't sufficient to impose the enhancement. He set the price, but he didn't command a larger share of the profits. He didn't exercise control.
But we don't know about that. He brings Purifoy. This is Purifoy we're talking about, right?
Yes.
He brings Purifoy in, so that's one thing that's a fact. He does front, so that's a second fact. He tells Purifoy what the price is going to be. That's a third fact. And there's this split. Now, I take your point that if it's a $100 sale and, you know, $80 comes back to him, we don't know what his cost of acquisition was. But I don't know that that necessarily says that he's still not a manager. He's kind of assuming the risk of the cost of acquisition.
I think all you can assume
but
from the facts.
But he's the person who's setting, who is determining what his accomplices. Wages. That's a manager. Manager tells the subordinates what they get.
I don't believe that he is. He's establishing what the price will be. He's not establishing what the share of profits is, and that's what a manager would do. A manager would command a greater share. A manager would exercise control.
But I thought he would keep $20 and return $80.
And we don't know from the record if that was a greater share of the profit, if he committed.
But it's
a
fixed
share.
Price. That's the thing. It's a piece transaction as opposed to a, you know, it cost us this time, right. $50 to obtain it. So it's, and I don't know, you could imagine some real profit sharing agreement, but this is just a flat price.
If I tell you, you're going to charge $100. And you're going to keep 20 and give me 80, or keep 80 and give me 20. Mm-hmm. That's a managerial decision. I am telling you what you get paid.
And that would establish a greater share of the profits, which would support the imposition of the enhancement.
Well, isn't that what happened here?
No, it wasn't. That was never established. What we have is basically, as if, I'll give an analogy,
well, where did
I start a business.
Where did I get this $80, $100 figures from? I make them up.
Well, I thought it was established that the price was $100 and that Henry gets $80 out of $100 and Purifoy keeps the $20.
That is true, but I'm saying with respect to profit, we don't
profit,
know
profit, we don't know, but just, why does that matter?
Because that is one of the signals of some greater culpability is if you're profiting off the work of somebody else, you should be more accountable in the criminal context.
Well,
we don't have that.
Of course, you're profiting off the work of someone else.
I'm not certain he is. If $20 is the whole profit,
people. You hire people to work for you, right?
It would be, Your Honor, if I were to start a law firm and recruit an associate or a partner, and that person was co-equal with me in terms of profits and responsibilities and activities and so forth, even though I was first in time, it doesn't show that I exercise control over that individual that I recruited, and so is the case here. There needs to be a greater development of the facts, and with that, if I can reserve
you're
the balance of my
time. You're saying the defendant couldn't have split, couldn't have changed the division of the spoils?
I'm not certain if he could. In any event, if there's no profit left over, if it's a $20 profit, he didn't profit more greatly and therefore wouldn't have that indicia of greater culpability.
I don't understand. He gets 20. If he gets $20 every time his sidekick sells this stuff, of course he's profiting from this other person's work.
My point is, I don't know if he's profiting more greatly.
So your point, as I understand it, is Purifoy keeps 20, Henry gets the 80, but you think if Henry had paid 70 to get the heroin to begin with, he's netting only 10 out of the sale. He's letting Purifoy keep 20, he's netting 10. Maybe I'm all off, but that's what I thought you
were
arguing.
That is one possibility, absolutely. But it could be a market share idea about maintaining control over the existing market. And so it's not a lost leader, but it's a break-even prospect, perhaps. We just don't know from the facts, and therefore we can't assess the imposition of the enhancement.
All right, fine. Thank you. Mr. Peterson.
May it please the court. As to the defendant's procedural argument, I would just point out that since the case is being, since we're agreeing that the district court committed error and that it needs to be remanded for a full resentencing, the other issues that the defendants raised as to the length of the supervised release term, the amount of fine, those issues can all be addressed by the district court.
So what about this leader thing? For once it's a full resentencing, if there are further facts to develop, is there any reason why they couldn't be developed on remand?
There's no reason why they couldn't. However, there's no reason why those facts couldn't have been developed at the original sentencing hearing.
Well, that's true of a lot of things. I mean, I gather the government might want to throw some additional fodder in too, right?
Correct. We, if the issue was reopened, then we could present additional evidence if necessary at the resentencing hearing. However, based on the record that the court has before it, there's more than enough evidence to conclude that the district court correctly determined that the leadership enhancement applied. The defendant exercised control over his co-defendant, Purifoy. He admitted in his plea agreement that he recruited Purifoy to sell heroin for him. Not just to sell heroin, but to sell heroin for him. And
do you think it's irrelevant whether Henry himself nets, as in my example, $10 out of the sale, or 20 or 40 or anything else?
Well, it's a factor for the court to consider, but all those factors that are set forth in the commentary, none of them are meant to be taken in isolation, or if that factor isn't present, then the defendant didn't exercise leadership. In this case, clearly, the defendant exercised leadership over Purifoy. He's the one that told him how much to sell the heroin for. He directed what split was to be given. And
and
to argue,
and this is just the two level. Nobody says he's an organizer. He's really kind of at the manager level, right? He's at the intermediate.
Correct. It was a small conspiracy, and Purifoy followed his direction as to how to package it, sell it. The defendant assumed all the risk. He provided the heroin to Purifoy to sell. If it was lost, then he wasn't going to get paid. Purifoy assumed no risk. He sold the heroin and got a share of the profit. So
well, that's true anytime there's fronting, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
But it's just another factor for the court to consider. And as to the criminal history category,
so do you think that the manager adjustment is correct anytime you can discern relative culpability, or is there some additional substance that goes into the application of the manager adjustment? You have to be doing a certain number of things before you can be called a manager, even if there's hierarchy.
Well, you have to exercise some control over the other person. And
so you think there is some substantive element that down on the peon level, maybe some people are more important than others, but still not doing things that would justify calling them a manager.
I think you have to look at all the factors in each case and then make the determination if there was someone was exercising control over another person. I mean, you could have a coworker and you could make a suggestion to that coworker, well, you should do this, and they follow it. Well, that doesn't mean that you're their supervisor. You have to look at whether there's
multiple
factors.
So, like, the people
factors.
Who sweep the floor may be helpful, but the people who take the money to the bank are probably more important than the floor sweepers, but neither one of them is a manager.
Correct, because they're not directing anyone else as to what to do or, what price to sell the product for.
Okay.
And if there's no other questions as to the leadership enhancement, I would just point out that we agree that the district court would be in the proper position at a full resentencing to correctly determine the criminal history points. And at that point, if the defendant, as opposed to at the original sentencing, objects to one of the criminal history point determinations, then additional information can be provided to the district court. So unless there's no other questions, we would just ask that the court remand the case for a full resentencing, but affirm the district court's decision as to the leadership enhancement.
Okay, thank you very
thank
much.
You.
I think you have about a minute, Mr. Hillis, if you have anything else. All right. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.